From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Just over a year ago, the FBI arrested a 25-year-old woman in Augusta, Georgia. The charge? Leaking top-secret information from the National Security Agency to the press. Last month, reality winner pleaded guilty to violating the Espionage Act. She was sentenced to 63 months in prison and 3 years of supervised release. Her prosecution is the first in the Trump administration's crackdown on whistleblowers. Jeremy Redman is a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he's been following the case since Winner was first arrested in June of 2017. He's joining me now in the studio. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning.
And with us also is Richard Griffiths. He's president of the Georgia First Amendment Foundation. He's encountered countless whistleblowers and would-be leakers in 25 years at CNN. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. Jeremy, I'm going to start with you. Based on your reporting, give us a portrait. Who is Reality Winner?
You know, she's a former Air Force linguist, and she was working as a contractor with the federal government in Augusta and had access to this National Security Agency document when she was arrested.
What is the document? What did she leak?
Yeah, so it's several pages of a top-secret NSA document that essentially talked about Russian efforts to interfere with our election system, to hack into it using a spear phishing sort of campaign.
So she was arrested after passing along this information to The Intercept. They published an article about Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. So how was she discovered as the source of the leak?
Yeah, so what happened is The Intercept, in reporting their story, sought to authenticate the document that they received from Reality Winner by mail. And they showed it
to U.S. mail?
Yeah, by U.S. mail. And they showed it to give a copy to the feds, trying to confirm the authenticity of it. And once the feds had it in their hands, they were able to track it down to Reality Winner. And there were a number of ways they were able to track it. But one is the postmark, of course, on the envelope in Augusta. But also just narrowing it down to who had access to this document and then who printed it out. And she was among those who printed it out. And it turns out, after she had printed it out, she was able to get it out of the area where she was working by stuffing it down her pantyhose.
So, postmarked from her own zip code, this was not a real act of cunning, was it?
A lot of people, her critics, question, you know, how she went about this. You know, mailing it. The Intercept also bears some responsibility, and they've come out and said that they had made, you know, some mistakes in how they went about reporting this story. You know, her defenders say, look, you know, she was trying to serve the public interest and show what the Russians were doing, which, by the way, at that time, the president was denying it all along, that the president had argued that this was a hoax, that the Russians were not meddling in the election system. But all the national intelligence community had agreed by consensus that it was a case that the Russians were involved.
Yeah, I'd like to circle back to that. But Richard, looking at 25 years at CNN, you came across many tips from whistleblowers. How did you determine whether a source or a leak was credible?
Well, you go through a sort of mental checklist, if you like. You want to know, do you have a relationship with this source before the person who is coming forward? Is this somebody who has given us material before and it worked out? You look as to whether the source has got documentation with his or her information to show that what she or he is saying is accurate and complete. Do you have the whole thing? How does the person know what they know? You know, what's the proximity of the person to the information? Do they get briefed on it? Do they write the report? Did they just simply read a report, or did they hear about it as gossip at the water cooler? So you do a bunch of evaluation like that, and then you're looking at the individual, particularly in a whistleblower. You know, is that source stable and in control? And a lot of whistleblowers have to be a little bit crazy to throw their employer under the bus and potentially give up their whole livelihood in order to come forward. And then lastly, you know, is the motivation rational, right? Why are they telling you this? Is the motivation to get their boss's job? or undermine the organization, or is it because there's some higher purpose?
What about that, Jeremy? At first, Reality Winner pleaded not guilty. She was denied bail, has spent the last year in jail. You've met her family. What do you think was her motivation for this?
We've never heard from her directly about this. So all we can rely on is what we hear from the family and supporters. And they portray her as a patriot who was trying to show to the American public what was going on with our election system. This story deals with the sanctity of our election system, national security, and the legitimacy of the presidency. And again, at this time, there was a lot of discussion publicly about did the Russians do it, did they not do it? President Trump at the time was denying it all along. And of course, we saw in February when Robert Mueller indicted 13 Russians and spelled out what they were doing, that indeed there was something to this, at least alleged by our federal government, the National Security Intelligence Committee, all had agreed by consensus. But all her supporters said, you know, this was her trying to serve the public interest.
She said, I wasn't trying to be a Snowden or anything. I believe that's what she told the FBI. But do we get a sense there are some clues as to a political motivation or some accusations that this was politically motivated? What substantiates that?
Indeed. You know, so there's the other side of this is her critics that point out that she was extraordinarily critical of President Trump on social media. Talked about wanting to burn the White House down was what she had written in some of the documents that the feds had seized from her home. She talked about fleeing overseas after doing this. They really portrayed her, the federal government, in the court case as a real danger to national security. But at the same time, too, this term whistleblower we keep using, a lot of critics don't believe she is a whistleblower. And some people see it narrowly as someone who is leaking information to go after fraud, waste, and abuse. That's not what this was about. This was about, you know, election security system. And then her critics also point out, look, you know, by leaking this document and the way you went about it and how this case unfolded and you ultimately pleaded guilty, that you've put other whistleblowers in danger who may have actually more significant sensitive information.
That's Jeremy Redman from the Atlanta Journal-Constitutional reporter. He's been reporting on the Reality Winner case. And Richard Griffiths is also with us, president of Georgia's First Amendment Foundation. What's your thought on that? I mean, what is the definition of a whistleblower?
Well, to me, a whistleblower is someone who is providing information to expose deception or wrongdoing on the part of one's employer, or information that is definitely in the public's interest. If you go back to Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers case, it was the entire expansion of the Vietnam War into the rest of Indochina, into Laos and Cambodia. And at that time, when that all went to trial and the Supreme Court ruled that the New York Times could publish those Pentagon Papers, Justice Black said, only a free and unrestrained press can effectively expose deception in government, and paramount among the responsibilities of a free press is to prevent any part of the government from deceiving the people. So there's always been a great tradition of whistleblowers providing a valuable role to society. And, you know, you can go back.
And the Pentagon Papers were saying that or showing that the administration had one line for itself, was talking internally and speaking a different way to the public. That's a question, however. It is still espionage as far as the government is concerned. I mean, can you make a case that I was doing it for the right reasons, or are you still going to get prosecuted for leaking?
Well, I think that this is the shift that has taken place, you know, with Ellsberg and so forth, that now the government is taking a very dim view of even the smallest leak, no matter how it informs the public or it gives the public information that is valuable and useful. Part of that is the volume of the WikiLeaks dump. I suspect that that's a big part of it.
Well, that was an absolute game changer. We wouldn't know about the National Security Agency spying on American citizen or leaks from other countries without Edward Snowden and those leaks.
Or Chelsea Manning.
Or Chelsea Manning, for that matter. So what does that mean in the case, Jeremy, of Reality Winner?
Well, you mentioned the Espionage Act, and this is what is really a big part of this case, is she was looking at, you know, 10 years in prison, $250,000 in fines. with this World War I era law that is aimed at spies. And the difficulty she was facing is that that law is a strict liability law. In other words, there's no public interest defense that you can mount with it, that I was doing it in the serve of the public interest, I was trying to do it for good reasons. Nor is it a defense whether your information you leaked damaged national security. It's whether you leaked the document or not. So she was up against extraordinarily difficult odds in the case.
Well, the Snowden and Chelsea Manning case also exposed in public opinion that some people thought, well, it's okay. I don't mind if the government is spying on me as long as our security is protected. Is that shift also going on in the public, as well as the shift of accepting this information as necessary?
Well, I'm going to push back a little bit on that and say, you know, with stories like the Veterans Administration, the whole mess with the VA secretary being forced to resign because he couldn't run his own agency, and hospital after hospital after hospital have multiple lists where they were telling the Congress one thing about patient wait times versus the number of people who had actually died waiting. And that information would only have come out as a result of the whistleblowers who spoke to CNN and other news organizations. So very often the whistleblowers, even today in other parts of government, are absolutely vital, even though that's not a national security issue.
What kind of protections are in place for whistleblowers now?
Well, the best one is for a news organization to do its job and not blow their cover. Mm. And I think that that's the biggest area. And a lot of whistleblower protections have been chipped away at by the courts over the years.
How is this sitting with reality winner? She's been exposed. She's been serving time in jail. Any regrets?
Well, we heard her read a statement at her guilty plea last month where she accepted responsibility. She appeared calm. She was direct. She spoke in an even tone when she spoke. She basically said, I did this of my own will. I have to say, you know, it was remarkable to see her come out and make that statement after spending a year in jail. I think you can't overstate the impact of spending a year in jail had on her decision to plead guilty. She was suffering from depression, an eating disorder. She had been attacked by a fellow inmate in the Lincoln County Jail, where she's been held without bond, and she had injured her knee. So all of that, you know, facing the Espionage Act and losing at almost every turn in court, I think all played a role in her decision finally to plead guilty.
And this is the first prosecution in the Trump administration. What does it signal for going forward?
Well, you know, the people that we've interviewed, among them whistleblowers, have said really they were making an example out of her in this case. She got 5 years as part of this plea deal. She'll be formally sentenced, by the way, soon. But that's, you know, she was looking at 10. The plea deal calls for 5. She's already served a year in jail. It's pretty strong sentence for that.
Yeah, case to watch. Jeremy Redman, reporter for the AJC, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Richard Griffiths, thank you so much. He's president of the Georgia First Amendment Foundation and a long veteran of CNN. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, just ahead, how did white flight to the suburbs contribute to blight in Atlanta? But first, we're going to get past the stigma of mental illness among communities of color. Get a report on that. It is on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. July is Minority Mental Health Month, and GPB Atlanta Morning Edition host Leah Fleming is bringing us a series of interviews and stories exploring the barriers between people of color and mental health services. Leah, thanks so much for hanging around today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Minority Mental Health Month. Why is this an issue that you wanted to cover?
So I've always been interested in mental health reporting. And as you know, May is typically Mental Health Awareness Month, national. And about 5 years ago, after doing all this reporting, I bumped into this Minority Mental Health Awareness Month that's happening in July. And I immediately became very curious as to why have a separate month to deal with mental health surrounding minorities. And what I found is that it's something that I guess I knew deep down inside, and that is in Black and brown homes, the conversation about mental health is very different than it is in white homes. And so I really just wanted to talk about that.
Well, you did talk to some people, a series of interviews, but let's listen to one that you did with Shanti Das, an Atlanta native and music industry veteran. And you sat down to learn more about her personal struggles and her Silence the Shame initiative.
So I was 7 months old when my father completed suicide. I actually grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. I have two siblings. My sister was, I believe, 8 and a half at the time. My brother was 5. And it was, you know, my dad didn't leave a note. So we didn't know why he, you know, did that. And I was really angry at my father. So for years, I wouldn't let my mom talk about what happened because I wanted a dad more than anything. You know how kids are. Mm-hmm. So it was embarrassing for me when people would ask, where was my dad? And I would just say, oh, he died, because I was afraid to tell people that he shot himself or that he took his own life. And I think for my entire life, there was like a cloud over me. There was a fear that I thought that maybe I would do it or that something was wrong with me. And so I really didn't start learning about mental health and wellness or mental illness until I was an adult. So here I am now, 46 years later, and I'm championing the cause around mental health and wellness.
Now, when you were growing up, did your mother talk to you about your own mental health?
So, no. My mom never took us to counseling. And my mom's African American, and I want to add that my father was of Indian descent. And I don't know, I'm just learning about South Asian culture and how mental health is looked at there. It's still quite a stigma in that community as well, which is what I'm learning. But no, my mother never talked to me about it. And I think, you know, my sister and I have had conversations because my mom has Alzheimer's now. So it's tough for us to even really kind of talk about what happened in the past because she doesn't remember a lot of that. But my sister thinks that my mom definitely went through years of depression because she would see my mom crying and she would hide it from us. But we never went to counseling. We never went to therapy. Now, we grew up Catholic, and I do know that my mom would talk to our priests at times, but we were not privy to those conversations. And so I'm just, you know, not sure what's what.
Yeah. Now, what about your own mental health? Have you looked into it? Have you had a checkup from the neck up?
My best friend completed suicide 4 years ago, and that kind of sent me into a depression. And I now realize that there were times throughout my career, I worked in a very high-paced entertainment, you know, industry, and there were times where I couldn't really figure out how to channel my stress and anxiety. After my friend completed suicide that next year, a lot was just going on with me in 2015. I think I was just talking myself into a downward spiral. I couldn't control my thoughts. I was crying all of the time. I think I was bringing back up feelings of my father and, you know, was something wrong with me? And I had had this storied career, but now I was doing more community-based work. I just couldn't really figure out what God was trying to tell me and also why I couldn't control my thoughts. And so one night in 2015, I seriously contemplated suicide. I was looking for pills in my medicine cabinet, trying to see how many that I had. I had planned out my funeral, had figured out how it would affect my family. And so I called and talked to a counselor for about 15 or 20 minutes, ended up going home and texted Pastor Warnock. Mm-hmm. We're both members of Ebenezer Baptist Church. And Pastor told me that I can pray with you, but I really need you to go get help. You need to go to the doctor. You need to see someone. And I'm so grateful to this day that he encouraged me to do that, because oftentimes in the African-American church and community, we're taught to, you know, just pray and things will get better
pray
and they'll go
it.
Away and pray through it. And you do have to pray through it. But I also think that just as if you received a cancer diagnosis or high blood pressure, you would still go see, you know, a licensed healthcare professional. Well, there's no difference with brain health and brain disease. And so I went to see a psychiatrist and started getting treatment and help. And I'm not ashamed. I'm actually grateful that I can share my story and my journey. And Well, there's always that word crazy, right?
Yeah.
No one wants to be labeled. So I think the labels more than anything is a big deal, especially with kids, because I think the stigma of having someone think something is wrong with you is really difficult in those years of you trying to kind of find yourself. And I know some parents might say, oh, you have a roof over your head, you know, your bills are paid, you have a car, mm-hmm. you know, you have nice clothes to wear. What do you have to be depressed about? But again, we all have mental health. And so if there are certain triggers, you know, that causes you to not be able to cope with the stresses of life, it could lead down a path of anxiety and depression if you don't understand how to handle it. They just need someone to listen.
Mm-hmm.
I think we oftentimes try to diagnose someone ourselves
mm-hmm.
and try to, you know, make them feel like, oh, you just need to toughen up. But sometimes people just need someone to sit and listen.
And just listen.
And just
yeah.
be. You know, and then you can try to encourage them to get the help that's needed.
Now, I know recently two entertainers, they opened up about their struggles with mental health. Janet Jackson.
Yes, I just read about that.
Right. And then also Mariah Carey. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, do you think that that helps make it easier to have a dialogue about mental health?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think the more people that are in the public eye mm-hmm. and spotlight, if you will, the more they continue to share, I think more everyday people are open because, you know, good or bad, right or wrong, society still looks up to our entertainers and our athletes. And, you know, I don't think it's fair to put so much pressure on them, but in a sense, they are our role models, mm-hmm. right? And so if they're brave enough to open up and share, you know, I think everyday folks like me and you are more mm-hmm. open and inclined to share. Also in the NBA, you had players like Kevin Love mm-hmm. and DeMar DeRozan who opened up and shared about their depression and anxiety. And as a result, I think other players, you know, are opening up to share. So I applaud people like Mariah Carey and Janet Jackson. And money doesn't solve all of our problems, because I think I saw a lot of comments on social media when Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain took their own lives. People were like, well, why would they kill themselves? They were both super rich. What do they have to be depressed about? And people are people. And we just have to understand that we all can go through traumatic situations and not know how to deal with it. Or it could be something that's been festering for years, you know. So the other thing, too, I want to mention that not a lot of people understand is the relationship of substance abuse and mental health. It tends to go hand in hand. Because I remember, like me, I'm more of a social drinker. So mm-hmm. I may have a, you know, cocktail at home after a long day. But when I was going through my depression, I started noticing that I was having one too many cocktails by myself at home. And alcohol is a depressant. And I finally was like, and I never had a problem with it, but it was enough for me to recognize, like, just, you know, mm-hmm. stop drinking because it's only going to make you sadder.
So why do we need a Minority Mental Health Awareness Month, do you think?
I think it's no different than having Black Music Month, just being able to highlight some of the issues that are still plagued within our community mm-hmm. and having a concentrated effort by people within the mental health field as well as our other licensed healthcare professionals. I think stigma, like you mentioned earlier, is still so prevalent and we're still so afraid and ashamed to talk about it that having an entire month to talk about it hopefully will get into the community and encourage people to, one, learn as much as they can about it, to remove that stigma even within their own household, mm-hmm. and to start being more supportive of those in the community. You know, remember the movie Soul Food and Uncle Pete? I think we all have had an Uncle Pete or a cousin in the family. You go to family reunion and like, oh, they're just crazy. We're going to take them their plate and you keep them over there to the side. And no, we have to like stop doing that. And we have to realize that there are real issues in our community. We still need so much help as it relates to mental health and wellness. And traditionally, therapy has been seen as something that, oh, it's just for white people, right? We don't really do it in our community. And that's not the case. Therapy is for everyone. And no one is immune. I don't care if you're Black, white, Asian, Indian, Japanese, you know, everyone can experience any sort of mental illness. And so we have to continue to educate, particularly our community, so we can remove those stigmas.
Shanti Das there speaking with GPB's Leah Fleming about her Silence the Shame initiative. This month, Leah is exploring stories of mental health, especially in communities of color, and she's here in the studio with me. Leah, I know that you're looking at particular stories. You're not looking, you know, at aggregate mental health, but what are some of the barriers between people of color and mental health services?
So the biggest barrier is stigma. Now, across the board, the stigma of mental health, it exists for all people, regardless of race, age, economic status. That does happen. But it's more pronounced with Black and brown people. And that is because in our country, we often feel like there's already a stigma that we have to deal with. And that's being a person of color in a culture that often views that Blackness, that brownness as a weakness. And we can't deny that there is implicit bias in our country. So it becomes much more difficult to admit that you're struggling with something else that might be viewed negatively. Mm-hmm. And then the second idea is, we are taught as Black and brown people, and I'm African-American, by the way, so this is radio, you can't see me, but we're taught as Black and brown people, and I remember this growing up as well, we're taught to be strong.
Toughen up.
Don't show any cracks, no mm-hmm. cracks. You have to be twice as good as white people in order to get what they have, what you deserve. So you have got to not show any cracks. But there are cracks that sometimes show up. And so we have to be able to talk about that. And then the other is fear, you know, just fear that someone will find out that you are struggling with even something like depression.
Well, this is a terrible result in some cases. A study recently published found that African-American children under the age of 12 are taking their own lives at roughly twice the rate of their white counterparts. Mm-hmm. Does that study look at any of the reasons behind that number?
Yes. So first of all, we should all be alarmed by that study. It was done by the American Medical Association, and it is in their journal. I believe it was May that it was in their journal, but it found that more elementary-aged African-American children have been taking their own lives, Black boys and girls, between the ages of 5 and 12. Now, it should be shocking that any child, regardless of race,
astonishing,
that they would be thinking even about suicide. But what the study did find is that there are some cultural factors, including the stigma of dealing with mental illness. And then they also found that implicit bias and misdiagnosis plays a part in that, where Black children might be more likely to be perceived as misbehaving in school, not able to sit down and focus. They're just hyper and they're just bad because they're Black. They must be bad, as opposed to actually suffering from PTSD. A lot of children are seeing violence and it's having an effect on their brain health. Also, just mental illness. They could actually have a mental illness that is being misdiagnosed. And so that's some of the things that the study addresses.
They're not getting the help they need. Mm-hmm. You also recently put together a short piece on hip hop artists talking about mental health. Now, this is a field characterized by bravado, right? You know, mm-hmm. people don't associate rappers with openness about mental health. You highlighted some people, including the Notorious B.I.G. and Kid Cudi. Now, how did these artists, B.I.G. is Biggie's dead, but talk about mental health in their music?
Yes. So they have talked about it. Even artists like Eminem, who's white, but comes from poverty. And I think that this also includes poor white homes. I think those conversations tend to skew more toward what's happening in Black and brown homes. But all of those rappers have talked about, you know, I use the pen as my therapy. And that's how I put it down. You know, I put it my tracks down and, you know, the pain is coming out in my raps. But I think that is a good thing, to express it and to talk about it that way. But you also need to seek mental health care. But it is a good first step in having the conversation, and even some of the pushback that they have gotten. I know Kid Cudi, I think it was, got some pushback from, I think it was Drake that threw some shade at him over that.
Because he was admitting that there was a crack.
Right. And, that must be some sort of weakness. And I think particularly Black men struggle with that, that it is okay for another man to admit that I have a mental health issue that I need treatment for.
You and Shanti went back and forth about the idea of church communities. Is there any intersection between faith and mental health in the African American church particularly? I mean, in your experience, how do they relate to each other?
Yes, very much so. So it wasn't talked about in churches a lot, because with Black folks, you're taught, keep that stuff at home, keep it private. But Shanti, through her Silence the Shame initiative, has actually gotten this conversation to happen from the pastor on the pulpit on Sunday service, at least once a year, talking about mental health, mental illness, what it is that it's okay to reach out for care. And yes, many Black folks are taught, just bring all those problems and lay them at the feet of Jesus at the altar, and prayer will fix it. But prayer without action is futile. So you definitely need to do more than just pray about it. You need to get a mental health checkup and be okay with talking about it, even going. And many churches are starting to also have ministers that specialize in mental health care.
Okay, we're up against a break, and you know what that is like, Leah. But so what are you going to be exploring for the rest of July?
Rest of July. Coming up, we are going to be looking at language barriers and in the Latino Hispanic community, immigrants, how they are getting care and ways to get that care.
That is GPB's Leah Fleming. She hosts Morning Edition in Atlanta. And all this month, she's exploring minority mental health from different angles. Leah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can learn more about minority mental health at gpb.org. And if you or someone you know needs immediate help, the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255. How is Atlanta's demographic changing, and how is that affecting housing? Stay with us. It's on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow, we're going to be speaking with an artist who pushes puppetry far beyond the kids' corner. Raymond Carr has created short films, music videos, and elaborate stage shows that provoke bigger questions about culture and fear and the human psyche. We hope you'll join us for that conversation tomorrow. The city too busy to hate has not always been an accurate tagline for Atlanta. After the Civil Rights Act of 1964 invalidated state segregation laws, many white Atlantans withdrew from integrated public pools and buses and parks, or packed up and moved to the suburbs. That phenomenon, white flight, happened in droves all over the country. More than 50 years later, the World Population Review ranks Atlanta as the second largest majority Black city in the U.S. Over the past decade, it's had the fastest growing population of whites moving in. So what do these shifts mean for housing? Rents have gone up by 7.5% in the ATL since 2017, and many people are finding it difficult to live in or close to Atlanta without going broke. So what will Georgia's largest urban area look like in the near future, and who's going to live here? I'm putting these questions to Jared Apperson. He's an economist at Spelman College, and Kimmery Rosenfeld, an Atlanta real estate agent. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So, Jared, I'm going to start with you because you wrote about this, an afterword to white flight. This was for the East Atlanta Patch, kind of tracing Atlanta's road away from integration and then back to it. So take us back then to the 60s. This is the dawn of white flight. The term alone makes it sound like sudden and singular phenomenon, was it?
In some cases, yes. One example that stands out to me is in Kirkwood, the elementary school one day had all white faculty, and then once they integrated the school, the faculty didn't return. And
that quickly.
So that just immediately, that quickly. And then in other cases, I think it was more of a slow change in neighborhoods and sort of generational change. And I think it continued for a long time in different parts. Even once the city was kind of, people had abandoned the city, you saw similar patterns happen in South Cobb and in Clayton County. And so sort of flowing from that original flight from the south side of the city flowed out further to other places more gradually.
And in terms of population numbers, you report between 1960 and 1990, Atlanta's white population fell from more than 300,000 to just 122,000 residents. This was concentrated primarily on the north side of the city. Less than half. That is kind of staggering. So when we look at white flight as a term, is it an easy term for what happened to many American cities in the 1970s, or is it more complicated than that?
So I think that it is something that was consistent across a lot of American cities. I think the thing that maybe motivated it was, I think, maybe a withdrawal from some of these neighborhoods that were more community-oriented to choosing neighborhoods that were more individual-based, where people had their pool in their backyard rather than this community pool that could be offered to all comers.
Huh, that's interesting. So they took their community into their own little nuclear family home rather than outside of it. We call it white flight, right? But it suggests that that was strictly about race. Was it also about those who could afford to move?
I think that it was primarily motivated by race and racism. And I think that the afford was something that they could use as a barrier to prevent access to this world that they wanted to create that was separate. Now that there was no longer a legal barrier for blacks to be a part of their community, they could use this financial barrier as a way to keep their white insular community. So I do think that race was the primary motivator, but I think that financial barrier was the way that these communities were keeping segregation at the point that segregation was no longer legal.
So was there an identifiable turning point when people of varying races or incomes started moving back to the city or decided to move here in the first place?
So I think, I think it kind of happened in Atlanta. It's happening in both directions. I think you've had a growth of a black middle class in Atlanta that now is able to afford some places in the suburbs that were previously inaccessible. So you've seen some integration outside of the city. And then you've also, I think, starting in the 90s going through today, have seen white people that are interested in moving back to Atlanta, I think in part drawn to some of the community that people were abandoning before, coming back now, and that's actually generationally something that people are looking for. They want to be a part of a neighborhood that doesn't feel like a series of insular houses, that is instead people outside spending time with each other.
So a little opposite, that the whites are coming back from the suburbs and non-whites are moving back out to these historically rich white areas, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Now we know one of the most integrated cities in the nation is Gwinnett County. And Kimberly, I'm wondering how these trends that Jared is discussing is affecting the market in the Metro Atlanta area.
They are and they're not. I don't actually see as much of a race divide. I live in Grant Park, which is probably one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the city, and I've lived in town since '89. So there are a bunch of people that never did leave and always wanted the community. Now, I am seeing more and more people that have gone off to college, come back, and don't want to be in the car 2 hours a day. They want to be outside in the neighborhood. They want to have the restaurant where they get their burger from and all know their neighbors. And you don't always get that in the suburbs.
So this is convenience and community.
It's convenience and community. And right now, I'm seeing a mix of both. Yes, it is probably more economics, who can afford and what area they go into. But a lot of what I see, no matter what ethnic group, social group you're in, one thing I ask my clients is, what do you do on a Saturday afternoon? What is your life? And then I can find the part of the city that they fit into.
Who is your typical client?
I go anywhere from first-time buyers to people downsizing. Mm-hmm. And I have actually sold all the way to the Alabama line, coming and down into Sonoy. And you have a bunch of different groups. You have a bunch of people trying downsizing and wanting to come in. You know, they've raised their kids. They want a smaller place. I have The entertainment industry is going a lot south of the city.
So this is these are people who are in the film industry, movie. So these are short-term leases for the most part?
No, some people are buying. They're either buying second homes or they're moving to Atlanta to make this their base.
So what are they looking for? Are they looking to, you know, settle in for a long time, or they just need a good place to live while they're doing a job?
A little of both. I've had one or two that have bought houses specifically for rentals. And then I've had a few that are, this is where they're going to live. When they get out of the entertainment industry, this is where they're going to come back. Their downtime, they're in Atlanta.
There are so many new apartments and condos being built all over the metro area. I mean, I've seen it called a tsunami of new housing.
Yes, it is.
How is that affecting the rental market?
Well, the rental market is getting pretty high. You're paying for location, and you're paying for how new some of the apartment complexes are. And they're actually sort of getting into competition with what you can put down on a house.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in a shortage in Atlanta of housing and rental.
Despite all the stuff that's coming online, there's a shortage.
There is a shortage.
That is,
we have so many people coming into the city that, yes, we're having a shortage.
Kimmery Rosenfeld, she's an Atlanta real estate agent. Also with us, Jared Apperson, an economist who's going to be teaching econometrics at Spelman College in the fall. What is that exactly?
Econometrics, and it's sort of the statistical side of economics for empirical research.
Well, so this is what you've put to work when you're looking at the long-range trends in Atlanta, the white flight out, now an integration back into the city. What are people who are coming back into the city looking for in their neighborhoods? You heard convenience. You heard, you know, something to do on a Saturday afternoon. How about the longer-term stakes, the schools, the services?
So I think that schools are one, especially for families, young families, schools are one of the hugest drivers of thinking about where people want to live. And what I've seen, and this is kind of outside of data analysis, more people that I know around Atlanta, but I think in the same way that people are looking for community in their neighborhood, they're also approaching schools in a little bit of that way. And you know, people are buying an old house that needs some work to fix it up. I think they're also thinking of schools in that way and moving into some neighborhoods that where the schools have not had as active of parent organizations and those kind of things. And they're wanting to be a part of that community and build toward a high quality school system. So I've seen that happen in several schools around Atlanta.
Well, one of the things that I found really astonishing that over the past 10 years, the number of white children under five, you reported in your article, living in Atlanta grew by 51%, which is a huge shift relatively quickly. This is specifically impacting areas like East Atlanta, Edgewood, Kirkwood. How does that influx affect the kinds of development being done or rejected in these areas?
So I think that, the fact that families are part of who are choosing to move in rather than sort of the historical thing, which was, you know, 20-year-olds move to the big city, and then once they have their family, they move away. I think definitely you can see driving around Kirkwood or East Atlanta, the single-family homes, the townhomes, the spaces that are being built for families, not just young single people who will eventually go somewhere else.
So how about, you know, things like shopping centers? Is this, if you're talking about community, is that the kind of thing that is welcome or is that the kind of thing that is pushed off?
So I think it seems like people have a maybe elevated sense of what their shopping center should be like. And when there is, for example, a shopping center coming in and they don't feel like it's engaging with the street in the way that they want it to, it feels insular. You see a lot of uprising against that and a lot of pushback against it. And if it feels like it's not taking into account the impact on the nearby neighborhood, you see that. So I think just last week we had an example over by Piedmont Park where a developer wanted to put in a large development at a corner that's already a really congested corner and has a lot of traffic issues. And the neighborhood pushed back on that, and that development is now not going forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're definitely seeing engagement beyond people's own house with what do we want this community to look like, and that flows into the type of spaces for commercial property as well.
Right, and these are homeowners in many cases in those mm-hmm. areas. But how about Kimry? You know, what are some of the ways that people are helping to pay their mortgages? Have you seen Airbnb or renting out rooms or building tiny homes?
I have seen Airbnbs. In some of the older neighborhoods, you see carriage houses, and they'll rent out the top. So there'll be garage underneath, apartment up top. And people going into the older neighborhoods that, you know, I've seen people going down into East Point, College Park. They're going into some neighborhoods that they might not have thought of when they first were looking to afford the home they want. What's nice is they're being welcomed into the neighborhoods.
So oftentimes the idea of going into old neighborhoods and rehabbing old homes was a first wave of gentrification. This is not the same thing, are you saying?
Having been lived in those neighborhoods as long, I'm sure there are some people that think that, but I've only seen people be nice and cordial and welcome to the neighborhood and welcoming. Young families with little kids. I mean, it's grown to be in an incredibly great area that has always had kind of this same 20-year-olds
right.
move in and move out.
Mm-hmm.
These people are moving in to stay.
So what does it mean now? Is it a buyer's market, seller's market?
I kind of call it a market that everyone comes away slightly pissed. which means, you know, you can say things. You can say it's a seller's market. Sometimes there's several offers on the table. You can say it's a buyer's market because we have a shortage. But honestly, the house needs to be priced right. It's got to be a neighborhood that they feel comfortable in. And so when you get to the table, you just hope that everybody goes away with a smile.
Okay, how about our econometricist here? is Atlanta an integrated, more integrated city than it was ever before?
In parts, yes. I mean, there definitely are neighborhoods of Atlanta that are way more diverse today than they were in the past. My neighborhood is an example. I live in Southwest Atlanta. But I think there are also parts of Atlanta that have gotten so expensive that it is there's still a lack of accessibility to all income levels, and that does go along race lines as well. So I think there are spots of the city where we're seeing more integration than ever, and other spots where we're seeing the level of integration decline as they've gotten so expensive that they're not accessible to all buyers.
Well, and really interesting read. We have a link to Jared Apperson's article at gpbnews.org. Jared Apperson, economist at Spelman College. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Kimry Rosenfeld, she is an Atlanta-based real estate agent. Thank you.
Thank you.